This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Heidi Adams-Fitzpatrick in Washington, coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Villagers saved him from being abducted on Monday night by seven rebel fighters who they managed to chase off.
And that was Moki Edwin Kinzeka in Cameroon. Also, we get an update on the negotiations over Ethiopia's dam project on the Nile. We'll have these stories and more for you, so stay with us. There's lots more ahead here on Africa News Tonight. In our top story at this hour, residents of several communities in Cameroon's English-speaking northwest and southwest regions have attacked at least five camps belonging to separatist fighters. The villagers accuse the rebels of destroying civilian homes, looting and killing innocent people. The angry civilians say they do not know who they can rely on, as the military also commits similar crimes. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from the English-speaking town of Bamenda in Cameroon.
A group of 150 women and children in a northwestern village of Babungo sing a song against Anglophone rebels. They sing that they will together fight the separatists who they say have been abusing villagers. The leader of the group, 55-year-old farmer Marie Najela, says rebels in December accused her husband of helping Cameroon's military and then killed him.
The one for key we all, but for here we don't deny.
Najela says they are saying no to separatist plans to either eliminate all of them or see them suffer. She says all of them, including women and children, must work together to protect each other and their property. The women and children on Tuesday sang and marched to the house of their local traditional ruler, Ndofwa Zofia. Villagers saved him from being abducted on Monday night by seven rebel fighters who they managed to chase off. Zofia says he is grateful to his people and angry with the rebels who say they are fighting for the rights of English-speaking Cameroonians. Why should my people and I be tortured like this? He asks. Zofia says the rebels have abducted candidates for the local council and parliamentary elections, looted, collected ransoms, and killed civilians. He says enough is enough. Babungo is not the only Anglophone village in Cameroon with growing anti-separatist feelings over rebel abuses. Authorities, local media reports, and a rebel spokesman confirmed villagers have been attacking separatist camps. Last week, people from the English-speaking village of Balikumbat stormed rebel camps and seized their guns, along with items stolen from them, including goats and cows. The villagers say the retaliation was sparked after rebels stole a taxi driver's motorcycle because he refused to give them $10 in support. Cameroon's rebels have confirmed their fighters committed abuses. On Sunday, separatist fighters in the southwestern town of Kumba killed their commander, say local media reports, because he ordered them to torture civilians. Tapang Ivo Tanku is a U.S.-based spokesman for one rebel group, the Anglophone Defense Forces. Speaking via WhatsApp, he says they have ordered their fighters, who he calls soldiers, to arrest anyone who abuses villagers, including fellow rebels.
We are strongly condemning all of these soldiers who are turning their weapons against civilians, or who are stealing civilians' properties and not protecting civilians. This is adversely affecting the revolution.
But Tanku also accused the government of often framing rebels to tarnish the image of those fighting for the independence of English-speaking regions from French-majority Cameroon. Governor of the English-speaking Northwest region, Deben Chofo, denies any such manipulation. He says government troops are gaining public confidence and working to bring peace.
The security forces, the administration, the traditional rulers, and the entire population are doing their best to bring back a normal civil life. We are enjoying relative calm, even if we still have hot spots.
Rights groups accuse both Cameroon's military and separatists of using excessive force during 3 years of armed conflict. Unrest broke out in Cameroon's English-speaking regions in 2016 when teachers and lawyers protested the dominance of the French language and French-speaking officials. Rebels took up arms a year later, demanding a separate English-speaking state they call Ambazonia. The conflict with Cameroon's military since then has killed about 3,000 people, many of them villagers, caught up in the fighting. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Babungu, Cameroon.
The U.S. Department of the Treasury's Office of Foreign Assets Control today sanctioned the first vice president of South Sudan, Taban Deng Gai, for his involvement in serious human rights abuses. The Treasury Department says Deng has acted to divide and sow distrust within the Sudan People's Liberation Movement in opposition and the Nuer community. It says that has extended the conflict in South Sudan and harmed the reconciliation and peace process. Treasury says Deng reportedly arranged and directed the disappearance and deaths of human rights lawyer Samuel Dong Luak and SPLMIO member Agri Idri. In September 2018, South Sudanese President Salva Kiir and opposition leader Riek Machar reached a revitalized peace agreement that called for the formation of a national unity government. The deadline to do that has been postponed twice. Staying in East Africa, Egyptian, Sudanese and Ethiopian teams are meeting in the Ethiopian capital of Addis Ababa for a final technical meeting in the negotiations on operating and filling the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam. Irrigation ministers of the three countries, along with observers from the United States and the World Bank, are at the meeting, the fourth and final round of talks in the negotiations. The talks are part of the roadmap agreed upon during a meeting in Washington in November to break the deadlock in the negotiations. At the Washington meeting, participants set a 15 January deadline for resolving the dispute, but so far there has been no breakthrough. For more, VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shanawi talked with Joseph Siegel, director of research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies in Washington.
I see the ongoing discussion as positive to the extent that they continue to focus on the technical issues surrounding the management of the water from the new dam. You know, all along, this has been a technical issue, and there are valid concerns on all sides, and issues need to be worked out in terms of the technical dimension of the water flow. And I think to the extent that they can keep the discussion on that, I think it's very positive. It's more solvable than if the discussion becomes a political dispute between the two countries. And, you know, the differential that they're looking at now is less than it was in the past. So I think as long as all sides continue to be committed to a genuine dialogue on the technical side, I think it's positive. And I think it's important to keep in mind that the agreement isn't just about settling one issue on the water flow or getting to agreement at this point in time. They're creating what's going to be an ongoing partnership, an ongoing means of sharing the water on the Nile. And so it's important that they continue to build trust, confidence, and a good working relationship as they forge this agreement. And so all sides need to keep that in mind and not, you know, push so hard on one particular issue that they weaken this growing cooperative relationship that's going to be needed for everybody to benefit from what results.
But so far, the three countries have tabled different proposals on the duration of filling the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, and Egypt's proposals call for relatively extended filling period. Would the United States' involvement facilitate reaching a compromise?
it's potentially useful to have the U.S. involved as a mediator. The U.S. has good relationships with all three of the countries involved, Egypt, Sudan, and Ethiopia. However, I think the U.S. needs to be cautious that it focuses its role in, again, reinforcing the technical dimensions of the discussion and trying to work out a moderated resolution based on those technical considerations. Likewise, the U.S. has to be careful that it doesn't get pulled into any sort of political level discussion here where it is seen as siding with one country over another and thereby compromising the broader relationship it has in the region. So to the extent the United States can be seen as an honest broker helping the sides reach a satisfactory mediated settlement, I think it could be a positive role.
But Sudanese Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok said his country's interests are identical to Egypt's stance with regard to the Renaissance Dam, and while he acknowledged the sovereign rights of Ethiopia to operate and fill the dam, he said its operation should not harm any downstream country. What's the way out?
The way out is to compromise and to continue negotiating. The challenges that we're seeing here with regard to the Renaissance Dam in Ethiopia are similar to other negotiations regarding riparian water rights when multiple countries are involved. And there is a body of legal and practical experience that requires all sides to take into consideration the right and needs of the other partners. You know, they're having to share this resource. And so all sides are going to have to compromise to some extent to what it would have been if water resources were entirely within their borders. And so, you know, that's going to require, you know, continuing to dialogue, continuing to look at the technical considerations, continuing to take into consideration the needs of all sides. And I think there are valid concerns on all sides that don't deserve attention. And I think so long as the focus of the discussion can be at that level, they'll find a solution. It may not be an ideal solution for each side, but I think they can find a workable solution where each side will get what they need to continue to take advantage of the resources that the Nile provides.
And that was Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, speaking there with VOA's Mohammed Elshenawy. South Africa's ruling African National Congress is celebrating its 108th birthday since its formation in 1912 and 26 years since it led the country into full democracy. While the party prides itself for a long list of achievements, some South Africans and analysts say millions of people have yet to fully realize the economic gains of the end of apartheid. Tuso Kumalo looks at the party's successes and struggles.
The African National Congress, ANC, plans a big celebratory gathering in the Northern Cape province this weekend to mark its 108th birthday. The party notes that when it took over from the apartheid government in 1994, only 36% of the population had access to electricity. Today, 8 out of 10 homes are electrified. 9 out of 10 people now have access to clean water, compared with 6 out of 10 in 1994. Over 14 million people are living in free government housing. Education and health care also have seen improvements. 9 out of 10 adults can read and write, while 4.5 million people living with HIV are on antiretroviral treatment. But historian Pitika Nduli says there are still millions who still lack these basic services. He says growing inequality has also shut down economic opportunities for many.
We are taking steps back instead of really moving forward. The issue of the land was to be reconstructed, our education to be reconstructed, our economy to be reconstructed. We chucked out that for macroeconomic policies. And those are the issues that also fuel the fires of corruption in the land.
President Cyril Ramaphosa, who is in the Northern Cape ahead of anniversary celebrations, says he is hard at work to ensure that all citizens benefit from the freedom ANC brought about.
The economy, yes, is in bad shape. There's less demand in the economy, and the investment needs to be upgraded. There's also the jobs challenge. All I can say is that we are not sleeping on the job. We know what the problems are, we know what the challenges are, and we are addressing them.
Political analyst Karima Brown, however, says many people are losing hope.
I think the ANC is very desperate to, one, to be appearing to be listening, two, to contain the idea that there's a fat party going on when people are struggling to get jobs, where children who've just written matric and passed perhaps might not get into university or get jobs. So I think there's a desperate effort for credibility.
One resident of Kamos in the Northern Cape who identified herself only as Wilma agrees.
I'm 27 years now, and I've been voting ever since for the ANC. I haven't even received a yellow T-shirt. I've graduated grade 12 with flying colors. I can't find work. I have three children of my own, but I can't find a house. Nothing. There's nothing here.
As the ANC prepares for its birthday party, many voters say they want the party to do more than praise itself. Thuso Khumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
And you're listening to African News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on The Voice of America. I'm Haiti Adams-Fitzpatrick in Washington. And at 21 past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Civilians are attacking Cameroon separatists, and Zimbabwe civil service unions plan to halt work. For more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Teachers in Zimbabwe have threatened that they will not return to work when schools open if the government does not review their salaries. And the Apex Council, an umbrella body representing government workers, said its members also will not go to work until the government reviews their incomes. Reporter Kudzai Zinavashe has details from Harare.
The Apex Council leadership passed a new resolution at their meeting Tuesday that departs from their past demands to the government. Gibson Mushangu is Vice Secretary of the Civil Service Labour Organization.
As Apex Council, we came up with a resolution which is too much different from what we have been coming up with, because the situation hasn't changed. The government hasn't shifted its purpose from what it used to offer us. So as Apex Council, we have agreed that we are still incapacitated.
Many government workers have claimed incapacitation over the past year, arguing that their salaries were so low they could not afford to pay for transportation, to go to work, and also buy basic goods. Mushangu says this year the extent of incapacitation is worse.
In fact, the level at which our incapacitation is raised to has come to a very tense one. We have resolved that we are no longer able to go to work. And we have agreed that we are going to declare a further deterioration to the government on our working conditions.
Zimbabwe's economy has been in a steep decline for more than a year, with soaring inflation and shortages of most goods. Government workers say inflation has eroded their purchasing power dramatically. They want their salaries pegged to the interbank exchange rate between the Zimbabwe currency and the US dollar, so they are paid the equivalent value in US dollars. He says the organization is to meet with government officials on Friday, but they will remain resolute in their demands.
We are going to have a feedback from the government on the issues that we have already raised to it on the interbank rate. We are not going to change our position. Our demands still remain the same, that let our salaries be pegged on interbank rate.
He says this is the only way government workers can be cushioned from the hyperinflation. Government has promised to review salaries this month. The Apex leaders say they had expected an extra allowance to help them get through Christmas and New Year holidays. However, the government did not offer one, so most civil servants had a subdued festive season. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinavashe from Harare.
Uganda has released 9 Rwandan nationals who had been arrested in that country during recent tensions between the two neighbors. Rwanda's government called the move a positive step towards mending relations, but says more needs to be done. Halima Atumani reports from Kampala.
Before journalists in Kampala Wednesday, Ugandan officials produced release forms for 9 Rwandan nationals who were in their custody for months. The release is a goodwill move by Uganda toward Rwanda after tensions flared last year over shooting incidents along the border. The 9 Rwandans released are Urayaneza Gilbert, Mugabo Nelson, retired Sergeant Rene Rutagungira, Etienne Nsanzabahizi, Claude Yakalemie, Emmanuel Ramucho, Augustine Rutaisire, Munyangabe Adrian, and Corporal Nzeyamana Haman. Sam Kutesa, Uganda's Minister for Foreign Affairs, says the move to withdraw charges against the 9 is part of an effort to de-escalate tension.
It is the hope of the Uganda government that the Rwandese authorities will reciprocate the gesture of goodwill that we are making today, and further assure you that any outstanding issues and concerns will be addressed in an open and transparent manner.
The release is in line with the recent memorandum of understanding between Uganda and Rwanda aimed at normalizing relations between the two countries. Rwanda's ambassador to Uganda, Frank Mugambage, called the move a step in the right direction towards smoothing bilateral relations and keeping the border open. Mugambage said he hopes Uganda will follow today's release with further action, including dealing with people the Rwandan government considers anti-Rwandan elements operating from Ugandan territory. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
Turkey and Russia today called for a ceasefire in Libya starting Sunday. The call follows talks between Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and Russian President Vladimir Putin in Istanbul. Turkey backs Fayez al-Sarraj's Tripoli-based government of national accord and has begun sending troops to support his forces. Russia has sent troops to back General Khalifa Haftar's opposing forces to the east, which are trying to capture control of the country. Also today, Fayez al-Sarraj met with European Union officials, including EU diplomatic chief Joseph Borrell, who earlier cautioned that Libya faces, as he put it, a watershed point. The EU wants to keep the Libyan conflict from spiraling out of control, out of fear that terror groups and migrant smugglers could take advantage of the chaos. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Heidi Adams-Fitzpatrick in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, do visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News that's coming up at 16:30 UTC. And for all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Charleston Mock, thank you for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5-minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
The Voice of America's global news program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest news stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. Our correspondents gather the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 17:05 UTC on The Voice of America.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.